recorded live at Lover and Beloved, a celebration of Sufi love and wisdom, sponsored by the Sufi Conference, held May 17th through 20th, 2001, in Black Mountain, North Carolina. Tape number GSC7, Sufism in Everyday Life, True Stories, with Sonia Gilbert.
Of that great supreme compassion and mercy. Allah, make us conscious of that place in our hearts where you reside. Our gratitude is here. Our joy is in that. Amen. This is the beginning of the saga that began in 1972 when friends told me that a man had come to Philadelphia who would fill me up. Anything that was absent, missing, was what they promised me. When I came to this little house in West Philadelphia, at that time, that's where we were, and I waited for him to come down the stairs, I had no knowledge or expectation of what this might be. I was not a dabbler in encounter groups or going to any places. I was trying to find out about man and God for decades through books. Anyway, it was not really happening. And then this amazing being came down the steps to give a discourse with eyes that were as bright as anything you could ever imagine, and the warmth of a heart that actually already reached out from his own chest to ours. We were seated on the floor, and he began in a very, very beautiful way, much more poetic, actually saying that he was nothing. God was all. And then he began by asking us, would we like to know how to overcome illness, old age, and death? Would we like to know about the 18,000 universes? And things like that, which were so engaging. Who wouldn't want to know that? And so we began, this was January of 1972, life with Muhammad Rahim Bawa Mahiyadeen, whom I only knew as, at that time, Guru Bawa. For so long, I had expected something of the places that I visited from time to time. And I would say, oh, this is a holy place. This is a holy place. And the inner knower, with whom I was really very familiar already, said, no, it's not. No, it's not. And I would say, why? And the inner knower would tell me why it was not a holy place. But when I came in front of Bawa Mahiyadeen, it screamed out at me and said, this is a holy place. This is sacred. This is what you've been looking for. Well, that was good. That was a very good beginning. Bawa himself began in, I think, one of the most splendid discourses of the creation, and you could actually experience it when he spoke it. It was all there. It was glittering, the lives that were yet to take form, but were life in the universe. It was all happening. And it was so marvelous. At the end of the discourse, he always greeted people warmly. A little hug was what everyone received. And he came toward me, and he put his hands on my head, and he said, you must not be too fascinated by the magic of mind. And I thought, see, he knows I have a good mind. And he did. and he did away with it in that one gesture. For the next couple of years, whatever I had taken in by intellect was no longer happening. Books were piling up as they were unread, left. Because I was really receiving his message in another stream of consciousness. Now, all of this, the happiness is that I came as a complete, you know, if you want to know how to be a baby, that was it. I was the baby in that time. And the discoursing was in a language I did not know, which was Tamil. It was being translated by people with British colonial English from Sri Lanka. And it was a good thing that I was taking it on another stream of consciousness. The amazing portion that was then opened was, what was I going to do about this? And so he had offered, in one of the very early discourses, that if we wanted to go to God, he could take us, but we had to come with the right tools. Now, I had no idea what those tools were to be, but I went home and tried to understand what it was that I was supposed to do to get these tools. And the mind immediately grabbed and said, oh, you don't want to do this. You might not be able to reach the other side. And then all the things, the attachments that he spoke about that you will have given up, you will have lost. You won't love art the way you do. You will not appreciate music the way you do because you will have given that up. And it really started to dig in, and I began to cry and cry and cry and cry. And I think it lasted on and off for 2 days over the weekend. And then wisdom, my treasure, my inner knower, grabbed a hold and said, wait a minute. How many things have you tried that you really worked at? Did you fail in? And I said, none. What makes you think that you will fail now? And I said, right. And that was the end of it. It was intense. It was the little aspect of mind that normally takes over, crept away, and truly never came back. It was that intense of a burnout. So I came on Monday morning and I said to that dear, precious teacher, well, I've gathered up my tools. I'm ready to go now. I don't even think he knew what I was talking about. It was like, that was that day and this was another day. But I really did it that way. When one first encounters a person like that, there's really no way to know or understand what one is in front of. It was the inner knower that knew and informed me. I didn't have any intellectual way to do that. But I knew from inside that everything that he spoke, I wanted to integrate. And everything that he was an example of, I too wanted to become an example of someday. And it reminds me of the story of cupellation, of how in the early times they purified gold. They would heat up a bone ash vessel to a degree that was hotter than it took to melt gold. And they would put gold in that was not pure gold yet, and they would heat it up, and the dross from the gold would disappear into the cup. And a bead of absolutely pure gold was left as an example of what pure gold is. And that is Baba Mahayadeen. So that was there, present before us at all times. But the most important thing to know is that the work that was presented was on so many levels that you could take from column A or column B or column C and work all day long, every day, just to try to get this new vocabulary and this new understanding moving. There were the seven states of consciousness, and there were Tamil words that described them. I found that I, who could memorize, you know, four acts of an opera in a foreign language, couldn't memorize those seven words. And I satisfied myself. I said, well, if you don't have that state of consciousness, what do you need the name for? The earlier ones were, of course, very easy, you know, awareness, feeling, awareness, intellect. It got different when it got to be judgment or evaluation. And then there was practical wisdom and divine analytic wisdom and divine luminous wisdom, all of it to be hoped for. Well, there was not only that, but then there was this thing about the body being made of all of these elements. And Bawa said five elements. It was earth, air, fire, water, and ether, which I later found out is what the Chinese believe also. And tracing the elements and what they do in our bodies became a major work also, because in fact, we want those to be in balance. We want those to be correct. And nobody ever presented me with this problem before. Then he spoke about the four religions of the body: Hinduism, Zoroastrianism, Christianity, Judaism, Islam. Well, that's a lot to try to understand and work on. So the work was the most work that I had had since the time that my singing teacher told me that when I take a breath, I must breathe out. The diaphragm has to go out. And that was uncustomary. Everybody breathed in. So now everything was changing. And this went on for quite some time, with all of the intensity and all of the sincerity that I could muster, because in fact, I wanted to know what he knew. Sincerity is a word that came about in a time when people were doing very much with marble. And marble, pure marble, was not easy to come by, but there was this pockmarked marble. And they would fill it with wax, cera. So a marble that was sine cera, without wax, was pure marble. That's what the word sincerity represents to me. There was no way that you could be in this kind of an endeavor with less than the purity of true sincerity, because you just could never make it otherwise. There has been good fortune in what happened. I think I was with Bawa only about a month when, after an intense 4 days of nonstop focusing, I came in the morning on a Monday morning and sat down, and everything went away except a very, very amazing power that seemed to emanate from where he sat. He was like a little rag doll on the bed, and this amazing power came toward me and enveloped me. I had no knowledge of Fana in that time. I had no knowledge of anything. I just knew that the power of God was at last felt, at least in part. And the beauty of it is that what lasted out of that experience is the knowledge that the power of God is enveloping us with that intensity all the time. But we don't experience it because everything else is in the way. And then I realized that that's why the verse from the Bible was, I, thy God, am a jealous God. It's not, God is not jealous. The point is, if you want something that is more intense for your life, or something that is even equivalent, you can't have that experience. That experience is only when nothing else is in the way, when there is absolutely nothing but God. So that was very good fortune. There was nothing, again, that registered after that. It didn't give me a particular work. It had done its job, and that was it. And I continued very, very strongly to try to understand the Tamil myself, because words are important to me. And I didn't really want somebody else's words. And I later began to study some Tamil so that I could gather that in a language that I understood. It was soon time for Bawa to return to Sri Lanka. The visas for everybody who had come with him, the doctor who had been with him, was part of the World Health Organization, and it was time for them to leave. And there was a lady who was the older sister of this family, who had been patrons for Bawa in Sri Lanka, came to me and she said, you must come with us to London and say goodbye there. I thought, isn't that extraordinary? I should get on an airplane and go to London. And she didn't really want to say goodbye to me. And I said, well, all right, I'll think about that. And then I thought, you know, maybe I could go all the way to Sri Lanka and find out what it was like for Bawa in Sri Lanka with the people that he had been with all those years. Well, that was such a strange new thought. I went to Bawa and I said, would you permit me to accompany the family and you back to Sri Lanka? And he said, don't you see this happy heart? And with that, it was done. Well, I'll skip all of the parts that had to do with our journey, which were remarkable in many ways, and come to a time in Sri Lanka when I would see Bawa sitting on the bough of a tree like a large bird. I would hear him discoursing to the people that he had always spoken to in those years, and see the environment in Sri Lanka that was a happy environment. He had his own ashram in Jaffna, but he was also treated as the major force of wisdom in Colombo. And everything that happened was like a princess in a fairyland. Everything I have a good imagination. There was nothing in my imagination that could have ever imagined this. But the day came when I was to leave. And I was astonished that I did not have a real emotional. That's not what was happening upon leave taking. I didn't cry. But the night before I was to leave, I felt a strangeness in my torso as I lay on the bed, and I fell asleep. And the next morning, Bawa said to me, your subtle body came to me in the night. Now, he had discoursed many times about the subtle body. You know, you take a body, and not in the Western thinking, does this often occur, that there is a subtle body? And he said, your subtle body came to me in the night, and it spoke to me in Tamil. He said, now anytime you want to, you can come to me. Well, I didn't know what happened. I had no idea. But this was a gift from him. When I came back to America, I tried to imagine myself in the way that I had been on that bed. And I wanted really to come to the fellowship house. I was in New Jersey with my children, and I really I wanted to be with my brothers and sisters in the fellowship. And I just hoped that maybe this would work. And the next morning there was a phone call, and somebody said to me, "Sonia, were you here last night?" And I thought, oh, this is too wild. And I said, "What makes you say that?" And he said, "Everybody was talking about how they could feel your presence here." And I said, "He did it. I can do this." There was another time when a young woman who was suffering from cancer, I had lost track of her. She was supposed to come to the fellowship and await Bawa's return from Sri Lanka. But in fact, she went to a friend who had a houseboat and did some hippie kind of thing, in spite of what good sense would have dictated. And I couldn't get in touch with her. There was no telephone, and I was concerned. So I tried this sending out my subtle body to find out where Carol Maria was. And what came back was that she had no money. Now, that's all I knew, was whatever I conjured up out of this experience. So I put a $20 bill in an envelope. I did have a post office address for her and sent it. And she later told me, she said, "You know, when your money arrived, I had $1 left to my name." So there's validity in that. There was another time when I was trying to find out how she was. She was down in Florida, and the information that came back was that there was no taker, that she was like dying. And I came to my housekeeper is also a very given to knowledge is like that. And I said to her, "You know, Nellie, I think Carol Maria is dying." Within 12 hours, I had a telephone call from Lockwood Rush, who is a doctor with and is in the fellowship. And he said, "You know, I don't think Carol Maria is going to live. They want to continue to finish these radium tests on her, and she already only weighs 80-some pounds. I want to steal her out of the hospital, bring her on the airplane to your house. Is that all right?" And I said yes, and then we made all the arrangements. But look how valid the information was. That was a strange kind of information, a gift of Bawa Mahiyadeen. The next understanding that was really a most important understanding was the value of emptiness. I talk a lot, and a lot of people around me talk a lot, and we think a lot, and like that. So there was going to be a new mode that was needed, a mode for emptiness. And in some wonderful way, I did understand how to begin to be empty. In fact, it was remembered from my childhood. I had wonderful, wonderful hours sitting on the curb in front of our house, just being sentient, just knowing everything that was making a sound, everything that moved, everything that came and went. And I really was not involved. I was just a sentient thing. And I think I never lost that capability. And so here was a time. I don't meditate on anything. I just go blank. And the ability that really comes with that is vibration. There is that. Later, when Bawa was discoursing, some of the things that will be coming out in a book in October called The Resonance of Allah, he spoke much, much, much about the resonance of Allah. And what happens to the creation that has emerged from that great power, out of that resonance, wouldn't we, hopefully, become a part of a vibration that really realized its resonance with Allah? It's just too wonderful. That understanding of vibration and resonance engrossed me for a very long time and ultimately brought me to the wonderful time when something Bauer had said, which I had refused to deal with, finally wanted an answer. And what he had said was, the body is made up of the letters of the Arabic alphabet. Oh, I thought, gee whiz, you know, I wasn't really going to deal with that for a long time. It was about a year and a half later. One summer morning, I woke up and I said, today I'm going to find out what that means. So I ran, got to the fellowship house. I was sitting on a little balcony, and I said, in my own Tamil, the 28 letters of the body, what are they and why? And he glanced at my chest, not my face. It was the heart that he wanted to take with him. And he took me on a journey into the heavens and down to the earth, all with numerical things, the astrological signs and the seven heavens, the openings in the body and the prophets. And it went on and on. And even though I've heard the tape, I can never memorize all the numbers and the way they went, because that wasn't the important thing. The important thing was that I was on the tail of a comet and I was going and going. And finally, it ended. And I knew something that I realized didn't seem to really come out of what he was saying. It came out of something else. And I said, oh, the body is an instrument. And every one of those letters is a sound. And those sounds are our communication with our Creator. And our bodies, as instruments, receive the sounds in creation. And that's how we have the continuing communication anytime. I was so happy. I went home and I said, ooh is here and ah is there. And I tried and practiced all the different sounds to experience them for real. And then understanding that and the joy of that, trying again with whatever imagination I had to make this whole operation happen. Well, I said, now I know the sender and the giver and the sender and the giver. The giver and the sender. As we send our message, God hears us and we hear God. But what is the middle? How does it happen? And then one night, 21 years later, or 25 years later, I was listening to a physicist on PBS, and he was saying that there were these teeny tiny points, infinitesimal points, that they call the strings. They prevail throughout the universe, and each one makes a sound. I said, there it is. They're the conveyors. The music of the spheres that everybody talked about is absolutely true. It's all there. But in contemplating these things, one has to be very, very quiet inside to wait for the announcements that come from the place where knowledge is. To be ready to be a receiver is our job. Most people pray for God to do this and God to do that. when in fact we should be praying that we would be ready for whatever it is that God gives. And we don't really pray for our readiness. We think we're ready. So there is that whole other understanding of what the receiver has to be and how clear. I know if there is one prayer that I give, it's a prayer for clarity. Once you have clarity, you have it all, or at least the chance for it all. Without clarity, you do not have a chance. So then came, what is it that would give one the property of readiness? And bowels. You have to get rid of all the attachments. There was the don't be's and don't do's, and then there were the do's. Be compassionate, be kind. In other words, start to employ the qualities that God has given to true human beings. And employ them as much as possible, because God is in his qualities. And when we are performing as those little creatures endowed with those qualities and are using them in that way, we're joined already. It's not hard. So then there's the watchfulness. I know that there was a time when I conceived, Obawa said that in order to gain the purity ultimately needed, we would have to go through 7 siftings. So, okay, 7 siftings. Well, the first sifting is easy. All of your big stuff that's not good is floating right around on top of this soup. And you can take a ladle and strain it out. It's a sifting. You can look at those things and say, oh yes, my friends told me this. Everything very obvious. And it's work. I mean, you have to work on it. You have to try to not be as angry, not be as hasty, and all of those things. It's hard work. And I worked, and then I took them off. And what I saw underneath almost made me lose heart. Because now, in smaller ways, there was all this other stuff. Having taken the gross part off, there was smaller stuff that was going to be harder to catch, harder to deal with. But I had signed on, I was committed. And so, in fact, I took a deep breath and I started again. And it went on for some time. And then the day came when I realized that there were 5 more siftings. And I really, it was hard. And I cried and I cried. I was driving my car down the river drive and I said, won't you give me a vacation? Won't you give me a vacation? And it didn't happen. I never got a vacation. It was just not doable. But I did work. And I got to other places, ever mindful of the work that had gone before, because slipping back is very, very easy. And the most important thing I did was to really keep track of myself, keep moving on to the inner, but really trying very hard. You know, if I stood still, I had 1,000 things to be concerned about regarding this path. That continues, and that will always continue. Somebody asked me at a seminar at which I spoke, and I will tell you about what happened not on the road to Mecca, but in Mecca. And it was very, very exalted experiences. And he asked, well, once you've had these experiences, do you have to keep doing things, ritual things? And I was going to say something, and something swatted it right out of my head. And the answer that came was so Bauer-like, it was really fun. And I said, if you bought the most expensive handmade car, wouldn't you have to maintain it? What would happen to it in 6 months if you didn't maintain it? And it was so clear that that was the answer. So maintenance of every kind is to be expected. And actually, it gets better and better. It's easier once you have something of great value to treasure it and to do appropriate things, to be much more careful than at the outset. It's just different. Well, you know, in all that time, I still had not become a Muslim. I was Sonia Gilbert. I came to Baal Mahayadeen. He didn't even allow the word Sufi to be much said at all in the beginning, because that makes people think that they know something. And most people don't really know what a Sufi is. They wouldn't know if they used the word. And so he said no. He was a teacher of wisdom. And from there we proceeded. But the day finally came when it was clear to me that his intention was to build the mosque in our backyard, all of it done by our own hands, a very, very nice mosque. And here was a new thing that was being entered into my understanding. And I thought, well, that's all right. I've received so much. I don't really need to do this. But what I found was a hiding little bigotry. And when I found it, it had to be excoriated immediately. And I said, okay, I see you. And now I will be a Muslim. And with that intention of being complete for God, I undertook that. It doesn't take much. Actually, what you do is you're a witness for the fact that there is one God, that Muhammad is a messenger, and that you will perform the five necessary things. Nothing could be easier. And I began my life as a Muslim. And then the day came when I was invited to come on Umrah to Mecca and Medina. Well, that was difficult because I didn't really have what I considered to be enough of a relationship with the Prophet to say that I was going on a pilgrimage. I had a very pilgrimage. Wow, I mean, pilgrimage is a word that encompasses so much. It was not something that a tourist does. This is big. So I tried to find out about this messenger. And I read Ling's biography, and that didn't do it. And then I read some hadith, and that got a little bit better, but that didn't do it. Not enough to say that a person was going on a pilgrimage. So I stood beside my bed, and I pleaded with that power, and I said, I'm supposed to leave in 2 weeks. I mean, since I was giving all the details, to go on a pilgrimage. I don't know your prophet. You know your prophet. You tell me, please, about your prophet. And as I stood there, the gift of tears came, and with it, a very interesting story began to unfold within me, putting me in the person, saying, now say you're a good person. Everybody trusts you. You are this quality of a human being. And he began, and the storyteller was beginning to tell me the story of Muhammad as this very, very special human being who ultimately became a messenger. And by the time I was finished hearing the inward story, I had experienced everything that I was reading in the histories and everything now was alive. And I could go on that pilgrimage because my appreciation for and admiration for what it was that had been done was complete. After thousands of years after Abraham, when the prophecy was that Ishmael would have so many and so many followers and believers, and it didn't happen, ultimately the burden became that of this wonderful man. And he lasted. He outlasted all of the enemies, all of his family, all of the reluctance, all of the stubbornness. And out of this one little man's effort, there are now 1 billion Muslims in the world. How's that for fulfilling a prophecy? God doesn't make promises that can't be kept. No matter how many thousand years it takes, I was in just, well, the reward came when I set foot inside the Grand Mosque with all of its fabulous lighting and everything, and they were talking about the Station of Abraham, the Corner of Abraham, Abraham's little footprints, and all, I'm saying, I never heard this before. This is the best kept secret on the planet. It's all about Abraham. And then I realized how alike those two lives had been. How the tribe from which Abraham came, they were making the idols. They were selling them. His father was selling idols that he made. And they were still believing in the powers of idols. When Abraham got that astonishing knowledge, and he broke up all the idols in his father's shop, it was tantamount to what happened in the life of Muhammad when he received that true understanding. And here his family is making money on all the idols inside the Kaaba that they stuffed it with. They took the opportunity of what there was their Ramadan at that time. Everybody wanted boons for their agriculture, for their flocks, for everything. And it was the Quraysh whose hands were given the money. His family and his tribe wanted to kill him. That's the old story about, you know, you're ruining my business. And that's exactly how Abraham's father felt. Come and get him. I don't need him. He's really making trouble for me. So then I saw this juxtaposition. And what a great reward when last year I was reading the Abraham on Trial book. And the story is that when returning from the Mihraj, Muhammad was speaking to his companions. He said, you know, he said, of them all, when I saw Abraham, I saw no one who was more like me than Abraham.